Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, while water is a basic human right, some 3 billion people face water scarcity, and some countries are running out of water. We'll explore the realities of water. Then, how much water is in those jeans you're wearing or in your last meal? How can our everyday decisions alleviate the water crises? Barbara Cousins is a professor with the University of Idaho College of Law and the Waters of the West Graduate Program. She is the author of Indigenous Water Justice, The Adaptive Water Governance Project, and Truth or Consequences, Settling Water Disputes in the Face of Uncertainty. Rick Hochebohm also joins us. He's the executive director of the Water Footprint Network and a PhD candidate at the University of Twente in Netherlands. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you with us. I've been reading in a lot of headlines and a lot of abstracts in the scholarship about the problems we're facing across the world with water, especially coming with climate change. And so I thought we should start with the scope of the problem. How bad it is, what are we seeing now, and how are things changing? Barbara Cousins, could you start?
Sure, I'd be happy to start. I think we have the intersection of two problems. Climate change is one, and that's changing not only where water is distributed, but how much at any one time, increasing extremes, so greater droughts, greater floods, and then just general trends of change within climate change that affect the kinds of crops you can grow and the way that people use water. But that's intersected with what people call the great acceleration, the fact that society is changing at an exponential rate. And that is illustrated in both population and the digital revolution. And so that changes how we live, how many of us are demanding water, and we all need water, and where we live. And so the combination of those things really means that we are going to have to adapt and adapt quickly.
So when you say the great acceleration driving some of these changes, can you specify what some of those changes are? I mean, you alluded to it with the kind of headings, but can you fill in the gaps about what we're seeing in the trends?
Climate change is one of the factors of the great acceleration. So we always have changes in climate over the long term, geologic time. But what the increased energy that humans are putting into the atmosphere is doing is causing it to occur in a human time frame very quickly, and a time frame that challenges our ability to adapt. The same is true of population. Population grows exponentially. And so to be able to provide safe drinking water globally is a challenge, even if the water supply is not changing. This just compounds it. And then our economies are changing at an accelerating rate through globalization and through the digital revolution. And so what that does is changes where we want to live, changes our daily routines, changes how we use water. So in many ways, it's not just a challenge posed by change, but by the rate of change. It's a rate that we're not used to adapting to.
Rick Hochebohm, what would you add?
I fully agree. And I would even go one step further, that even though it is tempting to attribute the water issues that we face to climate change, is that this great acceleration, as Professor Cousins framed it, is maybe even the major driver at this moment. We have growing economies, we have growing populations, and our modern lifestyles require a lot of water. And that is actually driving the water demand, which is overexploiting our resources.
You've started measuring or finding ways to measure what you're calling the footprint, the water footprint. And you've talked about in your work and with your co-authors about the industries and the demands that are causing the greatest sort of depletion of our access to good, clean, quality water. Can you walk us through what some of these are?
We indeed use the water footprint, as we call it, which is basically a measure, an indicator of water use, water consumption, because simply speaking, you cannot manage what you cannot measure, right? So we need to know how much water we are using and what we are using it for and when we are using it. And only when we know that, we can compare it to how much we have available, basically doing some bookkeeping with water rather than money. And then we can see where problems arise. And well, if you do this accounting exercise, you can do it on numerous scales. We mainly focus on the global scale. So we take more like a bird's eye view to see how we as a world population use and allocate our water. We see most of it is, of course, used in agriculture to grow the crops, to grow the food and the cotton, the food we eat, the clothes we wear. So that's definitely the sector where we use water most.
What can you tell us about the oil industry compared to other industries?
In general, I can say, though, that industry is maybe not as much a water consumer in terms of actually consuming the fresh water, but more a source of pollution.
So then one of the things, Barbara, you've talked about then is, well, how do we manage this, these changes that are going on, and how our thinking about these things are changing. So let's tie this into, so we've got water footprint that Rick is talking about, like how do we measure water? How do we know what we're up against? And then governance, on the other hand, how do we govern the system? What has been the governance system so far, and how is our thinking about that changing?
Well, it certainly varies across the globe, but as water becomes more scarce, so that's with all of the things I mentioned, just the increasing population and increasing uses, increasing demand for water. As that grows, you have to be more and more careful about how you manage water. So one aspect of that is having a much deeper understanding of where you're using water and what you're using it for. So our water governance varies globally, but in general, when you don't have scarcity, you don't have to be that careful about how you govern. So as scarcity increases, we have to tighten up on the way that we're managing water. And a real challenge, there's a twofold challenge to that. One is to do so in a way that you aren't increasing marginalization of certain communities, that you're not creating or exacerbating the haves and have-nots. It's very easy for economic systems to ignore certain sectors of the population. And the second thing that you have to do as you're tightening up on governance is just be more careful about how you distribute it. And that gets back to a lot of what Rick was talking about, knowing who's using what water where and how they're using it. And I guess I would throw in a third thing. The third thing is, with increasing rate of change, we have to do that in a way that's more adaptable. And that's not what we've done in the past. We've relied on the historic record of water supply in order to determine how to distribute it. As that changes, we have to be ready to adapt.
And so as we are thinking about adapting to this, what are you seeing emerging as new possible ways to govern?
Well, I've been studying what's going on in the United States, and what you see is at the sort of grassroots level, the level that's closest to the use of the resource, whether it's fishermen, river rafters, or irrigators, that they've become frustrated with the lack of ability to adapt and the fact that we don't integrate the way we manage water across sectors. We look at water quality in one place, we look at species at risk in another place, and we look at water allocation at another level. And so there have started to be processes that often start from the ground up, but sometimes they're triggered by a governmental process or imposition of a governmental regulation, where people come together and work to resolve conflict in more of a holistic way and come up with solutions that end up being watershed-wide or basin-wide and look at the system more broadly.
So Rick Hochobohm, let's bring you back in here, because your organization actually also looks at this adaptive governance. What would you add to this?
Well, it seems to me that the focus of measures to reduce water issues or water scarcity is usually focused on efficiency. If only we can install water-saving shower heads, for instance, we can reduce our footprint. And efficiency in agriculture by going to different irrigation techniques, it's all good, but it it's not enough to just make an efficiency gain on all these terrains. We should also see how much we have in absolute terms available in a watershed, which is the most typical unit of measurement that we use in hydrology. But of course, you have all the difficulties of scale, transboundary basins, where that is all very difficult. But still, we have to widen our scope to not only focus on small efficiency gains, but also see what system we're part of. And that even extends beyond the basin scale. It's not even how much water we only have available on the basin, but also how do our lifestyles depend on water that is coming from all over the world. In our globalized economy, we import stuff, goods and services from all over the place, and it consumed water or it polluted water at the places of production. So our whole system, our whole lifestyle is connected to all these activities worldwide, making it basically a global problem, which is, of course, very difficult to solve.
Yeah. I wonder also, Barbara, you had hinted in one of your books, not just hinted, I mean, you wrote about this a bit in terms of international governance. Already there are some things in place on the international level, but I'm a political scientist, so I'm also aware of the conflicts that are arising between countries over water and water scarcity, damming rivers, so one country gets it, the other doesn't, one country having swimming pools, the other country not being able to even get water out of their groundwater systems. What is currently in place globally, and what kind of changes are we going to need to make sure entire countries don't literally die of thirst?
You know, one of the interesting thing, people that have looked at this have looked at conflict over water. There's actually only been one armed conflict over water. And more often, people resolve the conflicts over water. And I think the big question is, will that continue as we have increasing scarcity and changes with climate change? I think that the efforts that people are making at diplomacy are essential. And there are a number of examples of transboundary agreements across international boundaries that can be used as models for how you distribute water across a boundary without interfering with the sovereignty of the other country. But those efforts have to increase, and particularly in the places that climate scientists believe will be the hotspots going forward in terms of water scarcity. And I think we're not learning how to do that at the same rate that climate change is unfolding. And that's certainly concerning. These systems are connected, and what the work of some people who have worked on these transboundary water disputes have found or have pointed to as the reason why you don't tend to have armed conflict over water is it's one of these shared resources that we only hurt ourselves if we get into conflict over it. So the upstream country can use the water and prevent it from flowing downhill, and they can also pollute it and prevent it from going downhill. But the downstream country can keep migratory fish from getting up the system, and they can keep navigation from going up the system. So there tends to be this shared interest in working out these problems. And I think also this underlying norm that we recognize that humans can't exist without water. So if you deny a whole people access to water, it's the functional equivalent of genocide. And so very often we are able to stop short of actual physical conflict when we're talking about water because of these underlying reasons. And so I think there's a lot of hope there, but I think we need to get busy.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the realities of water. The other thing that you started to discuss dealt with a commercial end of it and the haves and the have-nots. And can't remember who originally said this, but when speaking about the haves, saying, well, that's okay, we can always buy bottled water, you know. And then there is this whole sort of bottling industry going into regions where there is still clean water at the source, and then selling it. And How do you put this into the context of your studies, Barbara Cousins?
So let me go at that in two ways. One is sort of the haves and have-nots, and then the second is sort of how this huge bottling industry is affecting that. On the haves or have-nots, so we now have this international standard for the human right to water. And in the developed world, it's shocking. With my students, I use this standard to illustrate to them that our problems are first world problems. The human right to water is basically enough so you can have drinking water to survive. This is not taking showers. This is not watering your garden. And you can obtain it within a 0.6 mile walk. That's, none of us in the developed world live with that. And so when we're talking about the haves and, oh, and the third thing, it is meets the requirements of sanitation, with which billions of people across the world do not have that level of clean water. And so when we're talking about the haves and have nots, we're not talking about just people who are impoverished, but the possibility that huge parts of the global population will really be in dire straits as change unfolds. The water bottling problem can exacerbate that, but it's often playing out in places that are maybe at more of an intermediate level. They're not faced with not being able to obtain access to human right to water, but they are faced with potentially scarce supplies. And if you look at a map that shows the amount of groundwater available across the United States relative to freshwater surface water, it's huge. There's far more groundwater than there is surface water supply, but groundwater is not all of it renewable. Some of it is storage in place. And what we're doing with water bottling is finding some of these larger, really wonderful, pristine aquifers, and we're developing them in order to bottle water. And that water not only is sort of the buffer that the communities in those areas would have as surface water supplies change, but it's also often connected to that surface water. And so the impacts of developing that water are often not fully understood before doing it, but it's also not considered in the context of what does it mean to our adaptive capacity to not have that storage sitting there in place when surface water becomes scarce.
Rick, let's bring you back in. Rick Hochebaum, what would you say to all of this? The economics, the changing in the ecosystem, what do you see from your point of view?
Well, maybe to tap into this discussion on the bottled water, it always amuses me a little bit, because even though there may be and probably are issues, local issues where bottling plants are, I would say that this is definitely not our major concern. There's probably more water. I'm quite sure, actually, there's more water use and pollution in the manufacturing of the actual bottle than there's water going into the bottle. So it distracts maybe a little bit from the drinking water is not an issue. Even the bottled water is not, and not even the drinking water or even the water we use at home. It's in our food. It's in our diets. It's in our lifestyle. And that's where the major water consumption is, and where and what causes the problems. I don't know. Maybe it's tempting to blame bottlers or somehow for these problems, but I think it's more in the choices that we make, mainly in our diet. Take for instance meat that requires so much water. If you just do not eat one hamburger, you know, this week, just go vegetarian one day. You can shower as long as you want for the rest of the day to balance the water consumption that you have. There's so much more water going on in your average diet than in your daily home household use. So I think it's important to keep that into perspective, that those, how do you measure in gallons? We'll say we have 120 liters a day that we use at home. There's over 4,000 liters of water going on in the food that we consume, that we eat every day. And just put it in perspective, it's just 1%.
Rick Hochebohm, you've just opened up a new area that I'm very curious about. So I know that raising certain kinds of food, animals for food in particular, is a very excessive use of water, and also grains and natural resources of other types. Can you help us understand that process and why it is the case?
Very simply, we can either eat the grains ourselves as food, or we feed it to the animals and then eat the animals. But the conversion efficiency of the grains and feeding it to the animals and getting the same amount of calories or proteins from it is very low. So we can probably feed many more people if we would all go on a vegetarian diet. But because of our affluence, because of our choices, we can afford meat, and we eat meat. We give the crops to the animals. The water that is used to grow those crops, of course, compounds. And that also touches on these issues of equity that we were discussing a while back. That definitely adds up.
So in terms of things that people in their own lives can do, people who are concerned about the social justice issues related to water, you're saying their diet makes a big difference.
It makes all the difference. That's probably also the best thing you can do as a consumer. I mean, it's obviously a good idea to install, as I referred earlier, to install a water-saving shower head. But you will make a much bigger impact if you change your diet, if you watch how much water goes into the product that you eat on a day-to-day basis. Probably you even save more water on the electricity or the power that you do not need to heat the water for your shorter shower. Than the actual amount that runs from the shower tap. So that's for consumers.
Barbara Cousins, what would you add to this thinking? Is this something that you consider in your scholarship?
Yeah, Rick is absolutely right that the amount of water that we consume for the production of food is far and away greater than our drinking water uses or our household uses. It exceeds it enormously. And so on a global scale, when you're thinking of the water balance of the globe as a whole, he's absolutely right that is the best thing we can do globally is change our diet. But I would also say, it was once said that all politics is local. And it's also true to a certain extent that all water consumption is local. We certainly have the concept of virtual water with moving crops, selling food from one part of the world in another part of the world, or selling bottled water in another part. But when you think about adaptation and adaptive governance, it is the contextual tailored solution and the adaptive capacities of the people right within the water supply that are going to determine whether they're able to adapt to change going forward or not. And then when you look at it at that scale, there is no panacea. There is no ability to say every single watershed in the world will be better off if you change your diet or if you do something else. It's kind of the fallacy of cookie cutter solutions. We have to work on local capacity and local governance for people to be able to figure out what works within their particular watershed, what works for that particular water supply, and how it's changing.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the realities of water. Rick Hochebohm, your response?
Well, I do think it is important to keep this global connection to the local consumption of water. In the end, as water managers of a basin or even of a farm, you are using water to grow a crop or to produce a certain product. And it would be nice to know where that product is going to. If it's something for local consumption, if it's something worth the money, especially if there's not so much water, if you ship it to the other side of the world. I definitely think that that is something that we need to know so that we can act upon that. So I don't think it's a pure local issue, and it's very good to keep this global component into account as well.
I'd like to turn just a bit, Barbara Cousins, to another thing in your book, which deals with this issue of water colonization. Can you talk about what you mean when you talk about water colonization and water rights with Indigenous people?
So a lot of my work in the past has been working on water rights for Indigenous peoples, particularly in the United States. But in recent years, I've learned a lot more about Canada and Australia. And all three of those nations are ones that were colonized by Britain. And what we see, so I'll just use the United States as an example. There our federal law recognizes that Native American tribes have rights to water. And in the last probably 30 years, we've made great strides in this country in both quantifying those water rights and providing funding to develop them. So we've moved a long way in that. But the impact of water colonization is that that's simply recognizing the right and saying, okay, good, now we can all move forward from here, is not enough. The legacy of that colonization is that not only were those rights suspended or taken away for over 100 years, but the populations that were here before European contact have been decimated. They were decimated by war, by disease, by movement onto reservations that did not have the same attributes always as homelands. And then the landscape that was relied on was changed. And so what some of the work that I've been working on more recently with others looks at is not how do we restore that. If you talk to many Native people, they would be angered by the thought that we're thinking about restoring them to some condition that existed 200 years ago. But reconciliation of that. So how do we not only recognize the rights and help in the development of that, but how can the capacity to govern and to take a seat at the table be developed among Indigenous people through their own vision, through their own Indigenous knowledge, through their own way of approaching the water resource in order to reconcile their uses with uses of others in shared watersheds?
So now if we turn to the global and we look down the road 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. I mean, already we're seeing some areas of the world running out of water, right? I just read recently South Africa is almost parts of it running out of water.
Yeah, day zero approaching.
Rick Hochebaum, what are we facing when we look down the pike 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? What do you see happening? And then let's talk about how we address that.
Well, as I mentioned, we focus mainly on the global level and see how we deal with our water. And studies that we did show that already now we have 4 billion people, so that's quite a percentage of the world population, experience water scarcity at least 1 month of the year. So that's already quite a big number, of course. And if we look at, well, where that is, of course, that is in the Middle East and near Africa, where there's not much much water. They already depend on the import of their food from places where there is a lot of water. For instance, from the United States. The United States exports food and thus virtual water, mainly to Mexico and Japan, even Australia. I looked it up. You would maybe not expect it because, well, it is a largely arid country, but still they export virtual water. And the European Union imports the water, even though we have quite some water available in the region. So you can, if you can just add these flows and do a little bit of the accounting, you can see that these flows are not sustainable. Australia cannot export water very much longer. The United States cannot export water virtually then in the crops that they sell very much longer. They will use it probably for domestic consumption. So what does that mean? That means that the regions where there still is water will have to beef up their production so that they can fill in the gap for, well, the regions that already rely on importing water now, such as the Middle East, which will probably never be able to sustain or be fully self-sufficient in terms of water. So the Europe will become an exporter. Latin America will have to export more. And also in Africa, there's still quite some undeveloped potential for increasing our crop growth. So those are more the major movements that you can see going.
You mentioned the Middle East, and I know that some of the countries there have turned to desalinization. What are the effects of that?
Well, for one, it's a very expensive solution, mainly for drinking water, although I know in Israel they also use it for agriculture. But it's something that costs a lot of money, costs a lot of energy, and is not something that is, what I expect is not something that's going to be the one solution that's going to fix all our problems.
Barbara Cousins, what would you add to all this?
I guess I'd add, I agree with a lot of what Rick has said, and I agree that it's a global problem and that there are certain changes that if they happened globally would help considerably. But what I would add is that solutions, and particularly getting people to buy into solutions, particularly those solutions that require changes in lifestyle, are local. And it is through building local capacity and engaging in the process of dialogue and education that communities are going to begin to grapple with this and find their own ways towards adaptation.
Last words, Rick Hochebaum?
Yeah, well, I think we may even be forced to change such local diets. For instance, I didn't even mention China and India, which are at the brink of going from exporting virtual water to importing it. If they ban the export of rice because they want to feed their own population, then we will have to change our diets regardless of our local choices.
I wonder if something has to be done on an international agreement level. Barbara Cousins, do you see something like that happening?
So are you suggesting a global agreement on water? Probably 10 years ago, I would have said yes. Today, as a pragmatic approach, I don't think that's likely. But I nevertheless think that agreeing to similar things is possible when people see it in their own self-interest. And many of these solutions that Rick is suggesting are in local self-interest. And so that and the fact, which he also just indicated, which I think is really important, that in many parts of the world, people will not have a choice but to adjust, will drive these solutions forward.
It's a shared responsibility. We all will have to do our part. Consumers, we as consumers can choose what we eat, what we buy. Businesses should measure how much water they use in their particular business, especially in their supply chains. Look across the fence. Investors who shape the future of the economy of tomorrow should ask questions about water to prospective clients. Governments, of course, need to know what they allocate their water to and water management. So everyone has its role to play. It's not one international global organization, for instance, the UN, that's going to solve all this for us.
Well, Barbara Cousins and Rick Hochebaum, it has been a great pleasure hosting you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Barbara Cousins is a professor with the University of Idaho College of Law and the Waters of the West Graduate Program. She is the author of Indigenous Water Justice, The Adaptive Water Governance Project, and Truth or Consequences, Settling Water Disputes in the Face of Uncertainty. Rick Hochebaum also joins us. He's the executive director of the Water Footprint Network and a PhD candidate at the University of Twente in Netherlands. When we come back, how our everyday actions can avert a large-scale water crisis. Stay tuned. Keeps on raining, love is going to break. If it keeps on raining, love is going to break. When the levee breaks, have no place to stay. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The world is fast running out of fresh water, according to experts, and the results could be very grim. More wildfires, droughts, rationing, less food, more hunger. The causes are linked to overconsumption and a growing human population. Can we reverse the trend? Our next guest says we can, and he has quantified how much each of us contribute to either the continuing water crisis or averting it. Tom Costigan is the best-selling author of several books, including The Green Book, The Everyday Guide to Saving the Planet One Simple Step at a Time, You Are Here, The Surprising Link Between What We Do and What That Does to the Planet, and his latest, The Green Blue Book, The Simple Water Savings Guide to Everything in Your Life. He joined us now in studio. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for getting the subtitles correct.
So, okay, let's start with the problem. You have said in your book that since dinosaur times, that we really have had the same amount of water. It sounds like you're saying that's all changing now.
Well, it is, because of a couple different things that you mentioned in the introduction. One is population growth, of course. So there's more of us. And then, of course, technology and the things that we use, our stuff. You know, the average home has 10,000 items in it in the United States. That's an awful lot of stuff. And things go into making that stuff. One of those things is water. So we're taking more out of the system just to create things for our own use as well as the things that we use. And then the other missing link of all this is our pollution of that water. So there's less fresh water or usable water. And we're seeing more and more of that. You know, Ban Ki-moon said that more people are dying from unsafe water than all the violence and all the wars in the world.
That's pretty profound.
Very.
You have mentioned that there is this global water cycle that occurs. Mm-hmm. So if we were just going to put this in simple terms for people, how this actually works and how it relates to how much fresh water we have.
Sure. Now you're going to make me get into the science of
No,
it.
You have to.
Now, but I'm glad.
Our audiences like that.
Yes. The water that falls onto the planet, just to put it into perspective from the water cycle, is about 3 feet that would cover the entire planet. In fresh water. So you start to take that away and chip away at it. And then all of a sudden you start to say, well, okay, water is molecules, H2O, two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen. We know that from school. These molecules bounce around in different ways. So the rain here in California may have been at one point water in the Great Lakes or snow in the Sierras or someplace in the Himalayas. So when you start to conceptualize it that way and see that we all share in this massive pot of water, we in the United States take twice as much as everybody else in the world on average. So the average person in the U.S. needs about 13 gallons of water on a daily basis. That's to drink, to bathe, to wash. We use close to 150 gallons each. In a third world country, they use 5 gallons. We use that in one flush of the toilet. So that is really the disconnect that we have to start to chip away at so that we can all make smarter decisions. And one of those ways that I get to in the book is through virtual water. And virtual water is the embedded water in everything. How much is in your blue jeans? How much is in your...
How did you calculate this? I was looking at all these numbers and I thought to myself, how the heck did he do this?
Yeah. Well, in the back of the book, as you saw, there's a massive reference section. So we use base ingredients. And once you start to get down to the base ingredients, how much does it take for a pound of oats, for example? 123 gallons. Okay, who eats oats? Cattle. How much water do they need? How much water is in the processing? So you start to see how we put the pieces together. How much water for cotton? Then we can start to say, oh, that's how we get 3,000 gallons for blue jeans.
You did this for furniture. You did this for, you did it for everything.
Yes, yes. I'm partially crazy because of it. A lot of calculations going on in my head, and really it just takes everything down to its base. And once you start to realize, you know, we make up a lot of stuff, but there are base ingredients for everything. How much, the cotton, and then you get into rayon, then you get into aluminum, then you get into certain food products, and you can really start to chip away at it again, to use that word, and break it down to its very basics, which I think is a great thing for everyone to do. Figure out what we're buying, figuring out what's in the stuff that we're buying, and whether that's on our back or whether we're ingesting it, it's a very healthy proposition for people.
Yeah, in fact, you broke it down in terms of, first of all, in terms of industry. So farming, I think you said, was the largest consumer of water, which makes sense.
Yeah, 70% of all fresh water goes to agriculture.
And then industry.
Mm-hmm. Second biggest, 20%.
And then the rest of it is personal consumption.
That's us, 10%.
So if we were going to look at an average American's lifestyle, and you were going to say, these are the 10 areas that people should address first, what would you say those top 10 are?
First one, energy. May be surprising to a lot of people. 50% of the water in the United States goes to create electricity. For every time you turn on the tap for just a few minutes, that's equivalent to a 60-watt bulb being burned for 14 hours. I mean, there's all these kind of calculations you can get into. There is a nexus between what we do and what that does. So energy is a big one. Turn off the lights when you leave the room. You save energy, you save water, you save money. Buy local. Forget about transportation costs. Also, how much water does it take to grow things in arid nations? A lot of people have Egyptian cotton shirts or sheets. Egypt, last time I checked, is a desert country. It's 100% irrigation. We forget about these things, so try and buy something a little local. Cotton in the United States is likely only 50% irrigated. So we can make smarter decisions by buying local, you know, thinking about what we're doing in terms of our energy use, and then seeing what are the biggest consumers in terms of the ingredients. So taking a look at our food choices and seeing, should we be buying, you know, peaches in January? Probably not, because they've been stored. There's a lot of water in these things. Can we recycle? Because when you start to look at the enormous amount of water it takes to create virgin ore for aluminum, it's massive. You can chop that down by an exponent by recycling. Then look at your other products. There's 3 liters of water to make a 1 liter plastic water bottle. That's without the water inside it. So you start to make these choices throughout all the shifts in your life and thinking about not throwing things away. You know, it gets back to the 3 R's. Reduce, reuse, recycle. That little cup at the bottom of the coffee pot that you toss out without thinking about it adds up to an enormous, enormous number, and it's in the book. And
yeah, you actually did quantify some of these. Let me see if I wrote any of them down. You used the coffee example. You said if one person keeps one cup of water from being sent down the drain, that we have enough to provide 2 million gallons to the 1.1 billion people who have no access to fresh water.
Well, that's everyone who drinks coffee, but yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. Just if you're drinking coffee and you're tossing that away, think about that. That one cup represents 590 cups of water, 37 gallons to look at it another way. So starting to think about, you know, things like coffee. Coffee's the second most traded commodity in the world besides oil. I mean, we have to start to think about what we're using, where it's coming from, and then being conscious and maybe a little bit more conservative about our use.
I thought the food choice section was quite interesting, too. And some of it, you know, I think our listeners probably know to some degree, at least they know that vegetables take far less water than does eating meat. Mm-hmm. But it's a huge difference. I don't know if I wrote down the numbers. Do you have them memorized?
Sure. I mean, if you look at swapping out, say, a veggie burger for a hamburger, you save 600 gallons. A salad
in one meal.
One meal.
Right one there. Meal, 600 yeah. gallons of water.
Yeah, yeah. It's about between 1,300 and 1,500, depends on the cut, of meat, of gallons of water for meat.
Now, for listeners don't understand why that is, the whole chain of the water, you started to say some of that in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I sort of cut you off. So why don't you explain that again?
Sure. Beef and any type of meat, of course, the higher you go up the food chain, the more water it takes. So beef, the cattle in the United States eat a lot of oats. Oats take about 123 gallons themselves of water to be grown. So you have that step in the cycle. You have to grow the oats, 123 gallons there per pound. Then once the cattle themselves have to be fed, you're into another equation of water. Then that meat has to be processed and packaged and then transported. So all of a sudden, it goes way up the chain as opposed to, say, you know, potatoes or corn or other types of vegetables that are just very low on the food chain. So, you know, the lesson there is to eat dirty and, you know, eat things that are less sweet. Sugar takes a lot of water.
Okay. And so then the other big issue, especially in the U.S. you talked about, is the garden.
Yeah. We use about 70% of our residential water for our lawns. Big problem with that. You know, we can cut back here in Los Angeles. As we know, we get to water twice a week. In my neighborhood, at least, a lot of people don't pay attention to that. And I, you know, try and make that known.
Come on, in L.A., they're supposed to be rationing.
They should be. That's right. But a lot of people aren't aware of it. And I think that's a great thing. As you probably know, we've shored up about 25% of our water supplies just from rationing. 23%, something like that. So, you know, once we start to think about what are we using it for, do we really need imported turf? Can we start to do things like Xeriscape? Can we then cut back on just, you know, the profligate use for our outdoor water plants? Just for plants alone, most outdoor plants, according to gardeners, are overwatered by 50%. Indoor plants by 90%. We don't think about it. We just think they should be wet all the time, but we don't realize how much water that really encompasses. And a little shifts in habit like that add up to a huge, huge, huge number.
The other one that was really remarkable was just when people leave the water running on their toothbrush.
Yeah, well, toothpaste itself is already 50% water. And, you know, every 2 minutes of the tap is about 5 gallons. So start to think about those people in the third world country again. There you go. You're back to that 5 number again, just from shaving, from, you know, keeping the tap running while we're brushing our teeth, and taking longer showers than probably we need to.
And one more on the number, which is, you said it's a myth that we need 8 glasses of water a day. Now, what are you basing that on?
I am not a doctor. I knew this one was going to come up. It does. There's been an awful lot of studies by the medical profession because they take a look at our food, and we get most of our water from our food. So we don't need as much as what we think. So when they say you need those 8 glasses a day, they're also taking into account the amount of water that's in your food. So certainly I'm not saying for anyone to, you know, drink less water. I don't want anyone to be hydrated. I don't want any liability. There are a lot of people, especially marathoners, who overhydrate, and people who work out a lot, they overhydrate. And that's a big problem that hasn't really gotten the exposure that it might when you start to think about
it. How much of an impact would it make if people cut their water consumption by a cup a day or?
Oh, millions of gallons. Millions of gallons. That's the thing we forget. You know, there's a few hundred million people here in the United States, and there's almost 7 billion around the world. And you start to do the numbers and calculate it out that way, we can make a huge, huge impact if we all did it. And that's the big thing.
And now there's some things that I thought people would want to explore that they could do in their homes, like the gray water systems and the rainwater capture. And I don't know how difficult that is for people. How hard is it to install something like that? And what are I know there's some regulations around them that make them difficult to do as well. So suppose our listeners were like, wow, maybe I can just capture rainwater and reuse it for my whatever.
Yep.
Or the gray water.
Yeah, the gray water system is a little bit more tricky because there are a lot of regulations about that, and it does take a plumbing type of equation.
Explain what it is first for some that don't know.
Sure. Gray water is the water after you, say, wash your face and goes down the drain, that comes out somewhere. That's gray water. It's not toilet water. It's not, you know, but it is a form of wastewater. It's not fresh water. So what can you do with that? Now, there are filters that you can use to get rid of, say, the soaps and then use it for your garden. It does get more complicated and more expensive, but you hit on a really good point, which is the rain barrel system. They sell them even at Whole Foods now. You can grab a rain barrel, stick it in your backyard. Some people put them on their roofs or underneath their gutters, and just recapture the rain that falls onto the roof. Now, in an average temperate zone in the United States, a family of four can actually live off that rainwater. They don't need to have any other source of water besides that. But when it does rain, we can actually use that. Now, there are 3 states where you actually can't, which is really interesting. In Colorado and Utah and Washington State, it's illegal to recapture or to capture rainwater.
Why is that? Why would they do that?
Because we're on a right of first appropriation law west, in the west here, as opposed to riparian law in the east. Rainwater, of course, comes down and fills up our streams and our rivers. Right of first appropriation means that if you're a cattle farmer and you came here and say your name's Bob and you showed up at the river and you start to take your water allocation for the year, so Farmer Bob takes his water allocation, that's how much he uses. Then Farmer John comes and takes his water allocation, he gets that for his life. Now, if Bob starts to capture more of that rainwater through his barrels, he's in effect taking away from John's allocation. So there's, you know, kind of a kooky, if you ask me, type of, you know, problem with that. But net-net, it's a good thing to do here in California if you can, and really, you know, try and reuse whatever we can do, whether it's through the rain or if you have the means and you have the knowledge and you're okay with it to try a gray water system.
The two other areas I just wanted you to touch on before we talk about how much of an impact this actually would make is travel and sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, traveling, because I've been traveling a lot for the book now, too, it's really interesting.
How big is your carbon footprint?
Yeah, and how much I do offset. And actually, okay, I must say the water.
Talk about the offset, too, while you're.
Sure, sure. Let me just put in a little plug for the book. It's the first water-neutral book ever to be published. I'm replenishing all the water that went into producing it.
Let me also, since you mentioned the plug of the book, let me also say the title one more time.
Sure.
This is the one that came out on the World Water Day.
That's correct.
And it's called The Green Blue Book, The Simple Water Savings Guide to Everything in Your Life. It's really amazing that you've quantified just about every single aspect of life in terms of how much water it takes. And it's got the water calculator in the back so that people who really do want to have an impact can actually calculate their water footprint.
Mm-hmm. And we just put it up on the site, too. So if you go to thegreenbluebook.com, there's a water footprint calculator people can use for free and just calculate their water footprint. And there's a groovy new video we just put on there, too, that explains a lot of this stuff in an animated way. But to get back to your original questions about travel, of course, when you start to look at not only the amount of water that's used for the plane and for the jet fuel and all that stuff, but planes also do another thing that I hadn't realized until I started getting into the book and the research, is that they disturb water vapor and create, you know, disturbances amongst where rain actually falls. So it really does have kind of a disturbing effect on the atmosphere. And the other thing is the plastic water bottles. When you go through security and you just see them stacked up, it's crazy. So people take the water bottle, they get to security and they go, oh, I can't even take it through. They end up tossing them out. So, you know, a lot of things like that that require water that, you know, we don't even think about, you know, There's some thinking has to go around that. And then sports. We mentioned, you know, the amount of water that we, you know, could or maybe should be drinking versus, you know, an over amount of water, overhydrating. And then where you actually play, what type of turf do you play on, what time, you know, of year do you play on
certain things. Is golf the worst?
And golf is the worst, but they're also the most conscious, which I found was fascinating. Go on to different websites now, and the PGA is all for kind of water-tolerant turfs. They're all for watering at certain times of the day to mitigate their use. They're really, really getting more and more sophisticated about it, as opposed to just saying, oh, too bad, this is what we do. And then, of course, the skiing community is really scratching its head because of global warming and climate change, saying, yeah, we don't have the seasons like we used to. So, you know, there are things that you can do to mitigate your footprint when you're playing sports and just, you know, try and be a little bit more conscious as opposed to throwing things out all the time.
Last question for you.
Mm-hmm.
If people really did become very water conscious and reduce their water consumption, would it really offset, say, what industry does? Or are we asking ourselves to do what industry should be doing?
I think that there's both of those things entailed, and they're not mutually exclusive. And I think this is where a lot of people feel like, even though they want to do something, and even though they may do a lot of things, that it doesn't make a difference, but it does. One, it makes a difference in your community and to yourself, so there's an ethical proposition there. But also, it sends a message. And if we all could start to, you know, banner around this stuff, it sends a message to industry. Look at the Prius. I mean, you know, perfect example. Let's not get into the technical problems today, But, you know, the fact that actually, you know, it was so well received in the marketplace and it's done so well for Toyota that it was a message that was sent by consumers. And I think that's the biggest thing that we can do is really to do things for ourselves that will in turn send a message to business and hopefully government will start to hear about it as well.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Tom Costigan. This book, the latest one, is called The Green Blue Book, The Simple Water Savings Guide to Everything in Your Life. Thanks so much for coming down and being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
Please welcome Ms. Chi-Yok Ling.
Native people, particularly Apings people, in the last 3 years have set up barricade after barricade, walking for miles from all their traditional lands and their homes in the forest to the massive winding logging roads that cut into the forest to reach the timber supplies. And they sit and they stand and they build very vulnerable fences of wood across huge logging roads, day and night in isolation from the rest of the world. Protect the forest because they are so desperate. When I speak to my friends in the forest, and I ask them, what does the forest mean to you? And they say, look at the mountains, look at the rivers, look at the trees, look at every plant, every leaf, every insect, everything that moves. That is our life. And I think this is precisely what Kyufu Oranen so eloquently mentioned just now. That nature is life, and we being part of our environment, we are just a part of that. Today we witness this whole conflict of values between looking at our environment, looking at our natural resources, whether it is the forest, whether it is the oceans, or whether it is the soil and water upon which we grow our food. When nature was meant to serve the needs of survival of human beings, today we see the greed of profit, the greed of corporations, as has been mentioned by Barry as well as the chief, the greed of corporations to privatize resources which are meant for the survival of humankind.
The Pacifica Radio Archives, the people's history since 1949.
I'm diving deeper, deeper for you.